Old Man. Once, it was in Mississippi, in May, in the flood year 1927, there were two convicts. One of them was about 25, tall, lean, flat-stomached, with a sunburned face and Indian black hair, and pale, china-colored, outraged eyes. An outrage directed not at the men who had foiled his crime, not even at the lawyers and judges who had sent him here, but at the writers, the uncorporeal names attached to the stories, the paper novels, the Diamond Dicks and Jesse Jameses and such, whom he believed had led him into his present predicament through their own ignorance and gullibility regarding the medium in which they dealt and took money for, in accepting information on which they placed the stamp of verisimilitude and authenticity. This so much the more criminal, since there was no sworn notarized statement attached, and hence so much the quicker would the information be accepted by one who expected the same unspoken good faith. Demanding, asking, expecting no certification, which he extended along with the dime or 15 cents to pay for it, and retailed for money, and which on actual application proved to be impractical, and, to the convict, criminally false. There would be times when he would halt his mule and plow in mid-furrow. There is no walled penitentiary in Mississippi. It is a cotton plantation which the convicts work under the rifles and shotguns of guards and trustees, and muse with a kind of enraged impotence, fumbling among the rubbish left him by his one and only experience with courts and law, fumbling until the meaningless and verbose shibboleth took form at last, himself seeking justice at the same blind fount where he had met justice and been hurled back and down, using the mails to defraud, who felt that he had been defrauded by the third-class mail system, not of crass and stupid money, which he did not particularly want anyway, but of liberty and honor and pride. He was in for 15 years. He had arrived shortly after his 19th birthday for attempted train robbery. He had laid his plans in advance. He had followed his printed and false authority to the letter. He had saved the paperbacks for 2 years, reading and rereading them, memorizing them, comparing and weighing story and method against story and method, taking the good from each and discarding the dross as his workable plan emerged, keeping his mind open to make the subtle last-minute changes, without haste and without impatience, as the newer pamphlets appeared on their appointed days, as a conscientious dressmaker makes the subtle alterations in a court presentation costume as the newer bulletins appear. And then, when the day came, he did not even have a chance to go through the coaches and collect the watches and the rings, the brooches and the hidden money belts, because he had been captured as soon as he entered the express car, where the safe and the gold would be. He had shot no one, because the pistol which they took away from him was not that kind of a pistol, although it was loaded. Later, he admitted to the district attorney that he had got it, as well as the dark lantern in which a candle burned, and the black handkerchief to wear over the face, by peddling among his Pine Hill neighbors subscriptions to the Detective's Gazette. So now, from time to time, he had ample leisure for it. He mused with that raging impotence, because there was something else he could not tell them at the trial, did not know how to tell them. It was not the money he had wanted. It was not riches, not the crass loot. That would have been merely a bangle to wear upon the breast of his pride, like the Olympic runner's amateur medal, a symbol, a badge to show that he too was the best at his chosen gambit in the living and fluid world of his time. So that at times, as he trod the richly shearing black earth behind his plow, or with a hoe thinned the sprouting cotton and corn, or lay on his sullen back in his bunk after supper, he cursed, in a harsh, steady, unrepetitive stream, not at the living men who had put him where he was, but at what he did not even know were pen names, did not even know were not actual men, but merely the designations of shades who had written about shades. The second convict was short and plump. Almost hairless, he was quite white. He looked like something exposed to light by turning over rotting logs or planks, and he too carried, though not in his eyes like the first convict, a sense of burning and impotent outrage. So it did not show on him, and hence none knew it was there. But then nobody knew very much about him, including the people who had sent him here. His outrage was directed at no printed word, but at the paradoxical fact that he had been forced to come here of his own free choice and will. He had been forced to choose between the Mississippi State Penal Farm and the federal penitentiary at Atlanta. And the fact that he, who resembled a hairless and pallid slug, had chosen the out-of-doors and the sunlight, was merely another manifestation of the close-guarded and solitary enigma of his character, as something recognizable roils momentarily into view from beneath stagnant and opaque water, then sinks again. None of his fellow prisoners knew what his crime had been, save that he was in for 199 years. This incredible and impossible period of punishment or restraint, itself carrying a vicious and fabulous quality, which indicated that his reason for being here was such that the very men, the paladins and pillars of justice and equity who had sent him here, had, during that moment, become blind apostles not of mere justice, but of all human decency. Blind instruments not of equity, but of all human outrage and vengeance, acting in a savage personal concert, judge, lawyer, and jury, which certainly abrogated justice and possibly even law. Possibly only the federal and state's attorneys knew what the crime actually was. There had been a woman in it, and a stolen automobile transported across a state line, a filling station robbed, and the attendant shot to death. There had been a second man in the car at the time, and anyone could have looked at once at the convict, as the two attorneys did, and known he would not even have had the synthetic courage of alcohol to pull trigger on anyone. But he and the woman and the stolen car had been captured while the second man, doubtless the actual murderer, had escaped, so that brought to bay at last in the state's attorney's office, harried, disheveled, and snarling, the two grimly implacable and viciously gleeful attorneys in his front, and the now raging woman held by two policemen in the anteroom in his rear, he was given his choice. He could be tried in federal court under the Mann Act and for the automobile, that is, by electing to pass through the anteroom where the woman raged, he could take his chances on the lesser crime in federal court, or by accepting a sentence for manslaughter in the state court, he would be permitted to quit the room by a back entrance without having to pass the woman. He had chosen. He stood at the bar and heard a judge, who looked down at him as if the district attorney actually had turned over a rotten plank with his toe and exposed him, sentence him to 199 years at the state farm. Thus, he had ample leisure, too. They had tried to teach him to plow and had failed. They had put him in the blacksmith shop, and the foreman trustee himself had asked to have him removed, so that now, in a long apron, like a woman, he cooked and swept and dusted in the deputy warden's barracks. He, too, mused at times with that sense of impotence and outrage, though it did not show on him as on the first convict, since he leaned on no halted broom to do it, and so none knew it was there. It was this second convict who, toward the end of April, began to read aloud to the others from the daily newspapers, when, chained ankle to ankle and herded by armed guards, They had come up from the fields and had eaten supper and were gathered in the bunkhouse. It was the Memphis newspaper which the deputy wardens had read at breakfast. The convict read aloud from it to his companions, who could have had but little active interest in the outside world, some of whom could not have read it for themselves at all, and did not even know where the Ohio and Missouri River basins were, some of whom had never even seen the Mississippi River, although for past periods ranging from a few days to 10 and 20 and 30 years, and for future periods ranging from a few months to life, they had plowed and planted and eaten and slept beneath the shadow of the levee itself, knowing only that there was water beyond it from hearsay, and because now and then they heard the whistles of steamboats from beyond it, and during the last week or so had seen the stacks and pilot houses moving along the sky 60 feet above their heads. But they listened, and soon even those who, like the taller convict, had probably never before seen more water than a horse pond would hold, knew what 30 feet on a river gauge at Cairo or Memphis meant, and could, and did, talk glibly of sand boils. Perhaps what actually moved them were the accounts of the conscripted levee gangs, mixed blacks and whites working in double shifts against the steadily rising water. Stories of men, even though they were Negroes, being forced like themselves to do work for which they received no other pay than coarse food and a place in a mud-floored tent to sleep on. Stories, pictures which emerged from the shorter convict's reading voice. The mud-splashed white men with the inevitable shotguns. The ant-like lines of Negroes carrying sandbags, slipping and crawling up the steep face of the revetment to hurl their futile ammunition into the face of a flood and return for more. Or perhaps it was more than this. Perhaps they watched the approach of the disaster with that same amazed and incredulous hope of the slaves, the lions and bears and elephants, the grooms and bathmen and pastry cooks, who watched the mounting flames of Rome from Ahenobarbus Gardens. But listen they did, and presently it was May, and the warden's newspaper began to talk in headlines 2 inches tall, those black staccato slashes of ink which, it would almost seem, even the illiterate should be able to read. Crest passes Memphis at midnight. 4,000 homeless in White River Basin. Governor calls out National Guard. Martial law declared in following counties. Red Cross train with Secretary Hoover leaves Washington tonight. Then, 3 evenings later, it had been raining all day, not the vivid, brief, thunderous downpours of April and May, but the slow, steady, gray rain of November and December before a cold north wind. The men had not gone to the fields at all during the day, and the very second-hand optimism of the almost 24-hour-old news seemed to contain its own refutation. Crest now below Memphis. 22,000 refugees safe at Vicksburg. Army engineers say levees will hold. "I reckon that means it will bust tonight," one convict said. "Well, maybe this rain will hold on until the water gets here," a second said. They all agreed to this because what they meant, the living unspoken thought among them, was that if the weather cleared, even though the levees broke and the flood moved in upon the farm itself, they would have to return to the fields and work, which they would have had to do. There was nothing paradoxical in this, although they could not have expressed the reason for it, which they instinctively perceived, that the land they farmed and the substance they produced from it belonged neither to them who worked it nor to those who forced them at gun's point to do so, that as far as either, convicts or guards, were concerned, it could have been pebbles they put into the ground and papier-mâché cotton and corn sprouts which they thinned. So it was that, what between the sudden wild hoping and the idle day and the evening's headlines, they were sleeping restlessly beneath the sound of the rain on the tin roof When at midnight, the sudden glare of the electric bulbs and the guards' voices waked them, and they heard the throbbing of the waiting trucks. "Turn out of there!" the deputy shouted. He was fully dressed, rubber boots, slicker, and shotgun. "The levee went out at Mound's Landing an hour ago. Get up out of it!"